Hey, Holly.
Hello, Dave.
How are you doing today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
I am doing great today. It's another musical day.
No, it's a Rocktober day. So happy Rocktober again to you.
Happy Rocktober to you, too. We got to keep this up. Rocktober rocks.
Yeah. This is a nice treat because we have Jude Cole, who, as you will soon hear, has a banjo sitting in his lap as we start our talk. So he's going to fiddle around on that. I don't know if you remember Jude Cole. Do you remember Jude Cole?
I absolutely do. Yes, I was a fan. I think he has a really, I always felt he had a really nice, almost like the blue-eyed soul kind of thing. You know, I first heard him in, I think it was in the late 80s.
Yeah, actually in 1990, he had a top 10 hit with Baby, It's Tonight, which sounds so 90s. I loved it. I went back and when I was listening to it, like, oh, great tie. Like the rock in the early 90s, just before grunge started, it was kind of leaning that way, but it was poppy and rock. And this is kind of what Jude was all about.
Super catchy. And by the way, if you go back and look at some photos, I believe he might have had a mullet.
I'm sure he did. So yeah, he had a number of hits. As I mentioned, Baby, It's Tonight, Start the Car.
He moves on to other things. Yeah. He moves on to other music-related ventures. Now he's back to recording, and he's got two new records. He's got a new record of originals.
Coup de Mon, and his covers album, which is called Coolerator, based off the C'est la vie song by Chuck Berry.
Not just cover songs, they're all cover songs from the 50s.
Talking with Jude, it's great to hear someone who pivots when he needs to, who is not afraid to get kicked in the pants and pick himself up and start anew. So it's a wonderful story that we hear.
You'll find outtakes from this interview with Jude on our YouTube channel, so check it out.
Indeed. We have new episodes every Friday, so please subscribe. If this is your first time listening, welcome to it. Let's get into it right now. This is Jude Cole on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
It says J. Cole.
Oh, it does say J. Cole. Look at that.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
J. Cole.
Oh, look how cool you look.
How are you two?
We're good.
Well, I have a banjo lesson at 11:30, but I asked him to push it back and I haven't heard back from him yet, but it's okay. If we go a little more than a half an hour, it's fine. But
banjo tuning, I hear, is a bitch. How does it go with you?
You know, it's really double hard for me because I was diagnosed with cochlear menires a few years ago, and I had lost about 98% of the hearing in my right ear. It sounded like a seashell. And so the normalest tasks, like going to a restaurant, was unbearable, and playing music was impossible. And so I went on this water pill, and I was on it for quite some time, and then I did, you know, massive doses of prednisone, and my hearing came back. And so I'm really careful with it now, but tuning a banjo is hard because of this this resonator, you know, it gets kind of glassy, you know, metallic. So I can come close, you know, the best I can, but, you know, it is what it is.
Well, how good are you on that thing now if you're just taking lessons?
Well, I'm getting better, you know. I don't have my picks on, but... that kind of thing. It's scrug stuff, but it sounds better with the pick on.
That actually sounds great.
Like being at Shakey's.
I do a lot of, you know. Shakey's, I will come over there. Don't even make me come over.
No, you know what? It's my
Shakey's is strumming, and I hate that banjo.
Well, it reminds me of Steve Martin, who's like, you can't play a sad song on a banjo. Oh, death and grief and sorrow and murder. Digga digga ding, digga 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 ding, digga ding.
It's interesting. I'm at that place at banjo where I'm actually, you know, I'll play on my own. I'm pretty good. And then I get in front of people and I forget everything I know. So the old childhood nerves come back. You know, it's weird, but I wouldn't think I'd have that. But I still do on instruments I'm not that familiar with. So I'm going to use you two now and see if I can get through the first part of Foggy Mountain. Ah, See, I mess up. And I don't do that alone. I get through it flawlessly alone. And then when I play in front of people, I become a complete novice. So
that was absolutely worth the price of admission. So, okay, I have to ask, because as a non-musician, a music lover, but a non-musician, how are there any similarities? Was it easier for you to learn if you play guitar?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm used to finger picking. I've been finger picking the guitar since about 1982. So that comes pretty natural. The only problem is, it's like saying, can you write left-handed? Well, you know how to write right-handed, so you are familiar with the process, but it is literally Japanese. So the picking style is counterintuitive to what you would normally do on a guitar. So the rolls on a banjo are just a different beast. So it took me a while. I started playing in 2016, and I very much in guitar fashion, like a year and a half, because I hit this hump where it was just like, you know what? I'm never going to be any good at this. And then like last, I don't know, about 7 months ago, I picked it up again because I thought I had gone too far to forget everything I had learned. And I'm over the hump now, so I'm learning more. It's a fun, yeah, it's a fun thing to pick up a new instrument later in life and learn.
And learning Foggy Mountain Breakdown is like Lady of Spain for the accordion. If you don't learn Foggy Mountain Breakdown, then you're not a banjo player until you master that.
That's exactly right. And actually, that's not even the song that led me to want to play. The song that led me to want to play is on the Dueling Banjos album from 1973, the Eric Weisberg album. Mm-hmm. And it's a song called Pony Express. And I just loved it. And I thought, you know, I just want to learn how to play that song. So if I can learn how to just play that song, I'll impress my friends and I'll impress myself and I'll be. But then it didn't stop there. Now I'm learning a lot more. And it's really fun. I really enjoy it.
All right. So you like learning the lesser known songs, which kind of leads us to your new album. Or actually, you put out two albums. But the first one, the one I'm referring to, is the one that came out in July, Coolerator. And this is a cover songs, but it's songs you might not be too familiar with. There were a few I knew. Dave Edmonds' Dear Dad song. I love that.
Well, that's actually a Chuck Berry song.
Oh, well, I just remember.
You know, it's actually
crossed. These are songs from the 50s, Dave.
I know. Well, we're an 80s podcast, kind of, so, you know.
Dear Dad, don't get mad. What I'm asking for is by the next semester, can I get another car? This one here is sickening on a wide dual road. Might as well be walking as to drive this old folk. Almost every time I try to go and pass a truck, if I ain't going downhill, Dad, I'm out of luck. Even if I get by, it's still a rugged rest. The way this old folk keep a hitting and a miss.
Well, it's Dave Edmonds cut that song, and I did it a lot like Dave's version. Because I was a big Dave Edmonds fan, and when I was with Moon Martin, we toured with Rockpile, of course, and I used to go to the bar with Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe sometimes, and we'd hang out, and Dave would ask me if I had any songs. And, you know, I played him a song I wrote called Paula Meet Jean, and he actually put that on one of his albums. And it was one of the first solo cuts that I ever got. It was the first solo cut I ever got. In other words, not co-written with anyone else. So his version of Dear Dad was really influential on me. But it dawned on me recently that, you know, that song is a letter to Henry Ford. And it's basically saying, my car sucks. Can I please get a Cadillac? And I thought, you know, that's probably like 1962, I think, is when that song came out. And it was never on any it's one of his best songs. It's not on any of his compilations. You won't find it on the Great 28 or any of his greatest hits albums. And so I have a feeling, you know, Ford didn't take too kindly to it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ford didn't take too kindly to a lot of things.
No. But
he's not a good guy.
Except making money.
Yeah, well, exactly. He did care about that.
Very kindly to making money. Now, why is your podcast called What Difference Does It Make? Are you Hillary Clinton fans?
I don't even know. Is that what she said?
What difference at this point does it make? The Libyan situation.
Oh, no. This was the Smiths song. We're an 80s-based podcast.
Okay.
And it's also our theory on life as well, you know.
Are you Morrissey fans?
we're Smiths fans. I'm a fan of this. I'm a bigger fan of the Smiths than.
Wait, now, why are you afraid to say you like Morrissey?
Well, Morrissey is kind of like Henry Ford in a way. He's
an angry young man. Yeah. Well, an angry,
yeah. He shares a few opinions. He's tough to embrace at times.
He's a hot topic, right? He's outspoken.
Exactly. He is outspoken.
We'll take Johnny Morrow for a.
I still love Morrissey as an artist. What about you?
I don't really care about his music that much, but I like outspoken artists. I respect it. We don't have enough of it.
Well, what about like Eric Clapton or Van Morrison? Can you tolerate that? What they're going through?
Yeah. Ted Nugent.
I don't care for his music, and I don't like his style or his approach, but I can agree with him on many things that he says. If you take the bravado and hyperbole out of it and you just read what he says, well, you can't really argue that hunting in Michigan, without it, these animals die of starvation and are miserable deaths. So it's not like, you know, you're not doing the planet any harm by hunting these animals. He's a real advocate for that. And it's just that his style is a little offensive. I understand that to people who come from the city. And there's a real separation in life now amongst like city people and rural people. And it's kind of, you know, for somebody like me who came from a, you know, small town of like 1,200 people, it's kind of sad to see that happen. But that chasm is growing wider and wider to the point where if you say you're rural now, it's like, what are you, one of them? You know, it's like, well, I don't know what's one of them. But everything's become divisive, and I'm not crazy about that.
Definitely more in the last few years. Where are you from? What small town?
Well, I'm the closest town you can call my hometown from is East Moline, Illinois, and it's the Quad Cities, the Davenport, Iowa, Moline, Illinois, and then I came from a town called Carbon Cliff, which was a little more out in the rural part of that small city. You know, a lot of people in my hometown had Southern accents, and it was Northern Illinois, so it was very gentrified.
And how's a small town boy end up in the UK with Moon Martin?
Yeah, it's a strange, strange trip it's been, right? I had never been anywhere, you know, at that point, and I was depressed. I was going through that adolescent depression, 17, just turned 18. You know, it was literally, I think I was crying a lot. You know, I was just really emotional about it. The whole thing. I didn't know what it was going to do with my life. Didn't see a future there. I got a Rand McNally roadmap. And, you know, in those days, like the roadmaps were, the cities were highlighted in yellow. And I just wanted to find the biggest spot of yellow that I could, because I was from such a country town that I wanted to see the city. And it was either New York or L.A. L.A. was warm. And so I picked L.A. And I sold my car and came out here for 1 month, had a friend who graciously let me stay in his place for a month. And in that month, he also helped me kind of get hooked up to a service that led me to Moon Martin. And then I was touring within a month after I arrived here and was on the Midnight Special and all these things I could only dream of, you know, so it was very bizarre.
Well, come on, operator, get me rolling on my line. Well, she know what I need to ease a craving in my spine. Cheerleader smile, Tijuana style. So daddy, maybe just don't know how to nudge.
Learning all about Jude Cole and his wonderful new albums, Coup de Mon and Coolerator, and we will learn more after the break.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our guest today, Jude Cole. It feels like you must be leaving a little bit out
of that story. Yeah, well, there is. Hard to condense it all, but to add surreal matters, even more surreal matters to it, I was living on my own. I had just finally toured enough to be able to afford a used car. So this at this point, I'm 19. Just turned 19 and I'm making like $250 a week. I bought myself a used Gran Torino and I used to go and just take rides by myself and listen to these new records. And one of them was a band called The Records. And I would like smoke about 10 bong hits and go, I didn't have really any friends in California. So I would just, I had my band, that I worked with. They didn't live near me. And so I would go out on my own, take these rides, listen to music. One night I come home after listening to the Records album, and I see there's a message on my recorder call. You remember recorder calls? You might not.
Vividly.
As old as I am. I know you're not. But anyway, at that point, I saw I had a message. I turned the machine on, and it's an English accent from a guy named Will Butch. And he's in a band called The Records and was wondering if I might want to join the band. And I thought, okay. And I'm high, right. Someone's fucking with me.
You're on candid camera.
I mean, it was weird. It was really weird, but it turned out to be legit. And a month later, I found myself in London in the Records.
Everyone's talking. The lights are all buzzing today. So much is gossip. I don't think they know what they say.
I know, that's amazing. So, I mean, you're So obviously you're familiar with Starry Eyes, and they say, can you play that song? And you're like, of course I can play Starry Eyes. But how? Yeah. So, I mean, you were familiar with them. How were they familiar with you? Did you ever find out that story, or who referred them?
Because Moon's producer, Craig Leon, was producing their new album. And he was the one who, they weren't real happy with their current guitar player, Hugh Gower, who did a very masterful job, I have to say. But the personalities, I think, clashed. And they wanted someone that they were, you know, could get along with better on the bus. And that has a lot to do with being in a band, you know.
Yeah.
And I got along with them famously well. So we just, and it was sorry to see it go. I was sorry to see it go. About a year and some change later, it became really evident that it wasn't going to work. The record wasn't selling. And they had lost funding for touring, and they had, you know, their deal was in jeopardy and so forth. And it was very sad to have to leave the band, but they wanted me to move to England indefinitely, and I wasn't willing to
Could
do
that. Could
not
do that. I mean, these are valuable lessons you learn, especially when later in life you become a manager. Like, okay, here's what we got. Here's some rules that we want to live by. And
that and 1,000 more.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly.
I always told Lifehouse, you know, I'm a good manager for you, not because I'm so smart, because I just made so many mistakes that I can prevent you from making them. And I did. I did prevent them from making quite a lot of financial errors and so on and so forth.
How did that transition come about? Like, what was it in you that said, I can do this. I want to do this.
Well, you've heard of Tony Robbins, right?
Yeah.
It's yep.
like an infomercial now. It was about 1997. Grunge had obviously taken over, and I was no part of any sort of hair band, metal band. I was never a part of anything, really. I was always a square peg. But if you kind of didn't do either the Dave Matthews thing or the grunge thing or whatever was going on in the 90s, I really didn't, wasn't a huge fan of any of it. And I realized it was going to be very hard for me to get re-signed. Have two kids and a wife, and I had to support them, and I just started to really doubt my ability to be able to do it musically. And then so I'm depressed one night, and I'm kind of like, you know, the walls are caving in. My manager had died, and all these kind of dominoes are falling, and I needed kind of a way out. And I was watching that infomercial. It was about 3 a.m. and I'm up in the middle of the night pacing, you know. It's right around the time where Princess Di had died, and I saw this Tony Robbins commercial with he and Lisa Gibbons. And I'm like, man, that guy looks really fucking happy. I'd like to be that happy for one day right now. If I could be happy for one day and look like that, I'll buy this thing. So I spent the $300 or $400 to get the CDs. And it's interesting, you know, it was a silly thing, but I was really, you know, what Rick Rubin says, you know, be coachable. And I always thought that was really good advice, because so many Americans aren't coachable anymore. Everybody's a know-it-all. And I think at that point, I was so humble and just like willing to take anything that could mean like paying a mortgage and making sure that we had food on the table, that I was very coachable. And the Tony Robbins thing was really interesting, because he made me kind of look at some beliefs that I had from instilled from maybe being a, you know, Catholic, old beliefs about money. He had me look at all the other possible skills I had, which I wasn't even thinking of, because I was thinking, like, how am I going to make it as a singer and a player? But it kind of dawned on me that all these artists had asked me in the past if I would manage them for some strange reason. And so I started to take that seriously. And I had met a young female through a songwriter friend in Nashville. Her name was Pat Bunch. She gave me a videotape of a young girl named Lindsay Pagano, who was 13. I got her signed to Warner Brothers. And Ron Aniello was producing a band called, well, what became Lifehouse. They were called Bliss at the time. And I got them signed to DreamWorks. So suddenly I'm a manager of two acts, two major labels. The next thing I know, Mo Austin brings me into his office, when he realizes that I'm not going to relinquish the management post, as they so often try to do with, you know, wannabe managers. They'll get the young punk in, and they'll make a better deal with the artist through him. And then they'll get a real manager in place. And so that's what they tried to do to me. And when they realized I wasn't going anywhere, he tried to get me a partner, and I became partners with Irving Azoff. So all of this crazy stuff was, I have a lot of beginner's luck in a lot of ways on that front. And I learned a lot from Irving. Irving is a very, very smart, smart guy. He was very connected, just a wonderful chess player at all. And I learned a lot from him. But then, you know, a few years later, Kiefer Sutherland, who, a dear friend of mine for many years, we started a studio together. So I'd left Azoff because I didn't want to do the drive. Well, I lived in Calabasas. Irving's offices were in Westwood. And then Kiefer and my new studio was in East LA. That drive was, I did it for a couple of months until I finally said, I can't do it anymore. And I went on my own. And I've been on my own ever since. I think that was like 2004.
That's pretty fortuitous to get connected to Irving Azoff like that, you know, because I think you could learn, however you end up, you learn a lot.
Well, you'll find when you have something hot, everyone becomes your best friend. No disrespect to Irving. He was very good to me. But you'll find that everybody wants you when you have something hot. And nobody wants you when you don't. And the business is really as simple as that. If I could give anybody, you know, any sort of quick study take on it, it's like, get something hot until you start knocking on doors. Like, don't knock on doors with nothing.
I mean, the scenario sounded almost like Almost Famous, except Almost Famous came out in 2000. So you're little with the manager.
Precursor.
Right. Yeah. Like the you were the starter manager that they were trying to get rid of. But of course, the experience, I'm sure, is like, no, this is, I'm not leaving this. I know exactly what I want, the band wants.
They did a whole production.
Yeah.
So here, I'll tell you this little story, and I don't think Ron will mind me telling this. Ron and I were partners at first, Ron Aniello, the producer. So we had agreed to manage Jason Wade and whatever band he developed. It was, like I said, it was Bliss at the time. We had agreed to manage them together. So DreamWorks, being as savvy as they are, did the deal with us. Clive Davis wanted to fly me to New York on his own plane and all this other stuff. I said, no, I'm going with Lenny and Mo and Michael. They were who I knew and loved, and I gave this act to them. But once this deal was signed, they called me into a meeting, and it was all the heads of all the departments. And they started drilling Ron and I. They called us into a meeting. They drilled us on things they knew we didn't know. And Ron started getting red and sweaty, and I started getting pissed. Because I'm like, you know, they were just bringing up all kinds of elevated topics that they knew we were new managers, and they were really putting the heat on us. And all I said was, you know, I don't have the answer for that yet, but I'll find out in 24 hours.
Right.
And in the parking lot after that meeting, Ron said, hey, man, I'm out. I said, what? He goes, I'm out, dude. I can't do that. I can't do this kind of thing. So he knew right away he wasn't minded in that way. He wanted to do creative stuff only. And I was really kind of tired of the creative thing. I had done years of it, and I was ready to have a more stable life at home. So I said, well, I'm hanging on and I'm doing it. And that was 22 years ago.
Hanging by a moment, man. You took that song to heart and to number one.
It was a pit bull move, and it was ballsy, but I knew what they were trying to do. And it wasn't as vicious as much as it was kind of their MO. All record companies' MOs are that. They get the young manager to get the band signed, and then they get their buddies in.
But that's great. I mean, that's what you want in a manager. That's, you know, it's like who's tough and can figure out the answer. And it's like, no matter how tough it gets, I'm going to be there for you. I'll figure out I don't know the answer. I'll get it, though, for you.
You need a manager, what you really want is the fifth member.
Yeah.
You
really want that fifth member. You want somebody who takes things personally, but not to the point where, you know, he acts irrationally, he or she acts irrationally. But you do want somebody that feels so closely to it that, and in my case with Jason Wade, I mean, it really did become, I was a fifth member and really his partner since the beginning.
Was your manager that way when you were in the early 90s? And did you feel like he was also a member of your band?
Well, I started out with a young manager. His name was Dennis Pregnolato from South Africa, and he was a very, very kind and good guy. I really, really liked him, and he was my friend. And I know that he tried, but I think he was a little more versed in television than he was in record company politics. And my first record on Warner Brothers came out and it just didn't even make a dent. And I thought, man, I'm going to lose my deal if I don't find some relationships here. And I left him and I found Ed Leffler. Ed Leffler managed Van Halen.
Yeah.
And he was an old manager. He was a guy that was very networked in for many years. I think he was a tour manager for the Beatles. Yeah. He had managed the Carpenters and Sweet and Sammy Hagar for years and then Van Halen. So he was very, he had a lot of relationships, but he had a huge ego. And he was the kind of guy who was like, I'll take care of it. And he would go in and he was the guy, you know, the old days you would hear about managers turning desks over in record company presidents' offices and things. He was one of those guys. And he would scream at the top of his lungs. And at the end of the day, you know, you don't know whether you got what you wanted or whether you got them pacifying that loud manager and then kind of screwing him on the back end. So I learned both from, you know, Irving had a style very similar, but he wasn't a loudmouth. He was just such a powerful guy that he'd basically go in and make threats and they would do what he wanted, you know.
Don Henley said he may be Satan, but he's our Satan.
Well, yeah. And I've seen Irving work and like a person can call and make a threat on him and he's got his phone and in five phone calls, he's got them. I mean, he can literally do that. He's that powerful. I used to tell my assistant because she would say like, well, you know what Irving would do? And I'd have to say, you know what? I have to realize I'm not Irving and I'm not going to send that kind of a bluff. I'm not going to be able to bluff people that I am. So I had to come up with a different style and mine worked for me. I was a little bit of an imposter. I don't think I'm an organic manager. I don't think that's really my calling. I'm an artist. As an artist, I began to notice that so many artists lived hand to mouth and so many of the executives had homes with swimming pools and cars and families. And I started to become envious. Like I saw the Eric Claptons doing extremely well, but there were so many more artists that were not doing that. And after my first album experience, I thought, wow, you know, I'm a lot closer to that other side of the spectrum. I don't know how long I could keep up the successful side. The radio hits were so hard to come by. The touring was so relentless that I think I daydreamed about having more of a sane job. And I think management really did help me in that regard for a long time. So that was 22 years ago.
Yeah.
And now with COVID, everything's slowed down. And I found time to kind of go, what was I up to anyway? So I, you know, that's the Coolerator record and the Kudamon record.
I was so interested in both of them, obviously, but Coolerator, first of all, I love the name.
Thank you. And Chuck Berry, we can thank for that.
Did you have a Coolerator?
Yeah.
Why would you wouldn't have a Coolerator. You wouldn't even know what that is.
The only reason I know what it is from the song "C'est la vie, c'est the old folks," goes to show you never can tell. The Chuck Berry, he says "Coolerator" in that song.
Yeah, that's from the lyric. But did you have a thing for 50s music? Did you have a passion for it? I know I read that you did this over time. That this was sort of a passion project, but 50s music.
Yeah, it was a real second. It was almost like a past life experience for me. The first tour I did with Moon Martin. The first time we went to New York City, so this would be 1978. Now, I knew of the American Graffiti album, and I knew some of the classic 50s songs. But we had a driver driving us from the airport to the hotel who was like a Frank Sinatra freak, you know, and he knew all the stuff in New York. I got a fucking doo-wop channel. You wouldn't believe this fucking channel, you know. And I'm listening to this kind of like, okay, all I'm in. Like, I got to my room at the Gramercy Park, and I put the doo-wop channel on. And I'm looking out the window at the fire escapes and the New York scenery, and this doo-wop music was like something. The band was going out that night to dinner, and I told them, like, I'm in. I'm sorry. I'm going to stay in. I was having too good of a time by myself just listening to this music and then recalling this life I might have had, you know, because it felt so familiar to me. And ever since then, I've just been infatuated with the doo-wop music, especially the slow stuff. So consequently, that's pretty much what I did on this record. I don't think I did any fast mub. I didn't do any of that stuff. But I did the song Desiree was always a favorite. And I tried quite a few more that didn't make the record too. I had to kind of cherry pick the ones that sounded more.
That'll be the sequel.
In the right place. You know, some of them just didn't sound right.
Yeah, you did do one. My favorite was The Flamingos, I Only Have Eyes for You. I think that's one of the greatest songs of all time.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's just a gorgeous song. And I tried to do it really more as a sycophant kind of fan, you know, like just a fanboy.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel there. Art Garfunkel already did a pretty good job of that. I like his version. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do one that was a little more true to The Flamingos version just to see if I could. And it's so funny, like little things I had to pick up along the way, like shibop, shibop. Shibop, shibop. It was late.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't late,
yeah,
it didn't feel right. So it took me some goes, you know, to kind of get that shibop, shibop thing down. And then as we were mixing it, it still didn't feel there. And the engineer was kind of astute enough to listen to the original version. And whatever he did, he panned it left and right and realized, oh, my God, they're using reverb only on one side. The other side's bone dry. And now nobody really does that in mixing. But we tried it, and it's like, oh, you know, the angels started singing at that point. Like once the reverb was just on the one side, it was like this parallax of perfection.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you. Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. I only
Yeah, that was really, the days of only, what, like four track or two track? You know, he had to kind of probably go back in time and figure out, you know, how did the Flamingos do this? How was this recorded? Well, like, you know, it's like the Beatles or something, you know?
Well, it is like the Beatles, because when they originally did the Flamingos, it was only mono, you remember. The stereo wasn't on yet. So they would have one side with reverb on it, because if they did both sides, it was too reverberated by the time you bounced it to mono. And or not bounced it to mono. It was in mono.
Right.
But they only had two tracks. So one track would have the verb. So then later when they made the stereo versions, then you heard that only one side had the reverb.
Yeah.
But they really mixed for AM radio back then. It was so cool. We had a great channel here in LA on AM. It was 1260 K-Surf. And they changed it to classical, and I was so bummed, because I thought, man, this is like, you were able to go back in time and listen to the songs of that era on the
on AM, yeah,
of that era, on AM radio, and they took it away. Fucking knuckleheads, I could kill them.
I think future career might be you could be a program director. Okay,
not in a million years.
I don't bring it back.
The Jack Nicholson line in one of those movies, I'd rather stick needles in my eyes.
I gotcha. All right. So speaking of which, the songwriting process, you're writing songs for the first time in 20 years, maybe, or why did you start doing this?
I never stopped writing.
Okay.
Most of the Lifehouse singles were Jason and me writing together. Of course, when I produced three of their records, I wrote a lot of their songs with them, and I wrote a lot on my own. Lindsay Pagano, when I got her signed, I wrote all of the songs on her record. I wrote with all the artists, most of the artists I produced along the way, Mozella and some others, but I never stopped writing. My main focus was in management, and so I kind of kept the blinders on there, but I don't know, you know, like I really wanted to see if I still sounded any good. You know, I think that was more important to me than anything, was like, can I still even do this? You know, when you're on the road and you're playing all the time, your voice gets really strong. Your ability with guitar is second nature. You don't have to think about it. And I found myself from years of management going like, ooh, I got to think about this. And my voice is very raspy and it's not as strong as it once was. So I didn't know what it would sound like, but I was really happy with the outcome of both records. Obviously I put them out. So
you haven't lost it. Is that where you recorded in your, are you in a studio now or are you or is this just a practice room where you're sitting right now?
I have a studio on my property and I just kind of walk to work now. And I did do some of it here. I did some of it in, I shared a, rented a room from Chris Lord-Alge in his studio, Can-Am. Some of it was done there a few years back, and then I'll work wherever. But the main thing for Coolerator was to use a similar process as they did back in those days so that you could sound, I really wanted it to sound authentically kind of 50s and 60s. So I that was a little trickier.
And one of the benefits of working from home is apparently you've got some talented neighbors who can help out on production.
I did, yeah. Pat Leonard. Pat would just happen to call me up one day when I was here doing my walkthrough. I just bought this property up in the canyon. And he said, well, do you mind if I come and see it? Because I'm kind of looking for a place. And he came and he liked it so much, he bought the place next door. So we were neighbors for the last 7 years. Now, he recently just moved, I think, to the East Coast. But he would walk down here with his synthesizer and just, put his parts on. And
he's like a play date. Just bringing his toys over.
It was a play date. And he's so talented that, all I had to tell him was, I'm just kind of going for this Adam Hart Mother kind of thing. Had a song kind of like a Neil Young meets Pink Floyd thing. And he brought his Nord keyboard down and just layer after layer, it started to really come to life as I envisioned it. Wonderful musician.
Summer sun is sinking. I don't know where you are. I don't know what I'm thinking, but I'm only sitting in a cafe, driving in your car. Don't know what I'm feeling, but I'm only far away. The night's approaching like a fighter to the stage. If I'm in for it, somehow I'm not afraid. Am I picking up that your heart might be gone? If it is, then bring it on. Summer sun is falling underneath the tide. I feel my life is calling and the future's ready for a hammer right over my head. If your love is gone, I'm going to bed.
It seems charmed that you would, that the way these things fell into place and the way it came together.
Well, I try not to put in, I've always gone with the elements, it's the Fountainhead Howard Roark thing of, using the elements. If he was in a desert, he would build his house and make it look like it was coming out of the sand and the rock, And so if I was making a record in a studio, I would often ask the receptionist if she could sing. And sometimes would wind up on the record, and so the things like that. So I like to go where it's easiest.
Why not?
Least amount of effort.
And two of my favorite songs are kind of polar opposites. I love I'll Miss You. It's just kind of a hooky pop song that was, I loved. And then the one that ends the album, Partners in Time, which I really, really enjoyed that. It was just something completely different from what you might expect from you.
Well, it's nice to hear that you like I Miss You, because I love that song.
Okay. And I love you. Yeah, I'm a hook guy. I love that.
Well, it's the funny thing about that record, and you'll hear this after I tell you, that I was really channeling Chrissy Hynde. So listen to that record again sometime and think Chrissy Hynde, because when I think of it, I go, it's really obvious to me who I was doing. I was doing me. Everything I do sounds like me to some degree. But I get inspired by things just like anybody else. And that one's really, it was a real Pretenders kind of circa 1984, 85 kind of thing.
Way down late. When the room is blue,
stay awake without dreaming of you. It's hard to accept this feeling inside.
And then Partners in Time was really a story that had happened to me, a true story that happened to me in Hollywood, that I was able just to channel one afternoon sitting outside my studio here. And it was really just a dictation. It came out very easy and very effortless. And it was like, wow, like that was just a gift.
It's all true. Where were you in this scenario?
I was recording Start the Car at Cherokee, and I was coming out of the studio late one night. It was around 2 a.m. And I noticed this man sitting at the bus stop, and I was living in Park La Brea at the time, and so I was on my way home to Park La Brea, and I'm thinking, like, what is that guy? That guy didn't seem right. He was very old, and I didn't think the buses ran anymore. And even if they did, where's this guy going at 2 a.m? He was way too old. So I turned the car around, and I swung by, and I pulled up at the bus stop, and I said, you know, I don't think the buses run. He said, oh, okay. I said, you know, if you could tell me where you're going, I'll take you. And he goes, okay. So I got him in my truck, going to work. I said, well, where do you work at 2 a.m? He goes, I don't know. I said, oh, okay. Well, as I pulled the car over, and we're both just sitting there, you know, and this is all, I got this in the lyric of the song. And then finally, he pulls up his suit sleeve, you know, it's like a Holocaust, you know, but he was all spotted and bruised and everything. He was so old, but he had a little bracelet on that had his address on it. I'm like, oh, thank you, God.
Wow.
You know? So I took him. It was down Melrose. I took him down Melrose and took him home. And this lady comes running out. They had been looking for him all day. That's actually happened to me 3 times. You'll be surprised what you can spot in a city
when you're open.
Yeah.
When you notice the behaviors of some of these elderly people, they just forget where they are.
He was waiting at the bus stop in Hollywood at 2 a.m. Drove right by at first, then I circled around again. He was wearing a Sunday suit, a folded kerchief in his pocket, sitting perfect and polite, like a nightlight in a socket. I said, excuse me, sir, but these buses, well, they don't run this time of night. And if you tell me where you're headed, I could help you with a ride. And he said, oh, I didn't know that. And thank you, yes, you can. So I helped him up in my pickup truck, a frail and kind old man, partners in time. Partners in time.
It's a really great song.
The song meant a lot to me after I finished it. I think I had gotten kind of emotional after I finished it, because it was like, wow, like as a songwriter, you know, I automatically am thinking, like, what other experiences have I got?
Yeah, right.
But as just a fan, I just thought, wow, that felt like something I leave behind, that I'm really happy to leave behind. I guess that's the best way I could put it.
You can't conjure up stuff like that. That's organic.
All right. When I was going down the Jude Cole rabbit hole, I looked on YouTube, and I love seeing Letterman clips where bands play with, you know, you get to play with the world's most dangerous band, which happened to you. And I love it when Letterman loves a performance from a musician, and that happened to you. So can you kind of touch on that, because it was great performing. You had the horns, you had Paul Schaefer and you know, Anton Figg and Will Lee. It was was it as amazing as it looked?
those things are always a bit of a blur.
Yeah.
I went to New York. I was in my hotel room. And this is honestly is the thing I hated about being a solo artist the most. I hated how I might look. Funny enough, like, did I look fat in these jeans? I was very, very, it goes way back with me, you know, just really square peg-ish, much more comfortable off the camera. And so my stress would be like, does my hair look right? Like, am I wearing the right thing? I don't feel like I'm this is stupid. And the last minute I'm like, oh, this looks stupid. Like, you know, so that kind of thing. I was very self-conscious about things like that. So those moments would go by in a blur because I was so in my head usually about something else. And then obviously like when it's time to play, then all the lights turn off and I'm focused on the song. And so I knew how to get through it. And the band obviously with Anton and like that whole band was great. You know, they were really easy to pick it up. I rehearsed with them, I think maybe two times. Yeah. And then we played it live. That was easy.
Our next guest is a talented musician, and get ready, this is a great song, ladies and gentlemen, and my promise to you is my holiday gift to you folks, it's going to blow the roof off this dump. He will be performing the title song from his most recent album. It's called right here, and it's called Start the Car. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jude Cole. Jude!
Tired of the pressure, so tired of the pace. Just wanna grab you, baby, and get out of this place. I got no chance of making it working downtown. I'm just walking slow and talking low, tired of going down, down, down. Start the car, we gotta move. This ain't no living, well, this ain't no groove. It's been a long, hard road. So come on, baby, let's drive it home. Start the car.
You ever look back at it and remember your feelings but see it differently afterwards?
Well, I remember like when I did Leno, they did a pre-interview with me and I was pretty funny. And then when I got on the show, I wasn't funny at all. And I tried to tell a couple of the more humorous things on my, and it didn't really, it fell flat, you know, because I think I was a little nervous. And I was always kind of remorse about that. Like, damn it, you know, I wish I could have made laugh. The Leno thing, I was much more comfortable because I dressed the way I wanted to dress. I wore a flannel shirt and my jeans like I'd normally just wear, you know.
That's when but you need a good manager, right? To tell you what you need.
You're always hurry up and wait. You know, the right. Television shows, especially the live late night things, they're always hurry up and wait. So you get there at noon, you know, or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. You have to wait in their dressing room. You have to go down into your rehearsal. Then you have to do the camera blocking. And then you have to get ready. Meanwhile, you've eaten like four bagels and cream cheese and, you know, M&Ms and donuts and everything else. And you're like, oh, I'm ready to go to bed now. You know, so usually those things are like a loss of a day. I didn't really enjoy them very much.
But it's there forever now. I mean, you know, thanks to YouTube.
After the fact, yes.
Yeah. Did you have a moment with Letterman? I'm sorry to go back to Letterman, but I'm just obsessed with that. No,
he shook her hand and said hello before. And he was very nice the way he introduced me and very nice about afterwards. But no, that was just one of those things. I think everyone at that point thought that I was going to be a big name.
Yeah,
I even felt that. And it was very weird how it didn't really happen. But, you know, I've tried to explain to so many people who are like, dude, man, you got screwed or whatever. I'm like, you could not have scripted a better life for me the way it worked out. I was not cut out to be a star, not personality wise, not in the amount of work that it takes to be a traveler. Like, so it literally, if you'd have given me a pen and paper and said, write your perfect life out, I couldn't have done it better than it worked out, you know, the way it worked out. So a lot of people think that I wish I would have been bigger, and I don't.
One thing that's going to work out better is you're going to become a better banjo player. Can't make you miss your lesson. We've taken a lot of your time. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much.
This is great. It was really, really nice to chat with you, and I can't wait to hear the banjo stuff. Maybe you'll record it someday.
You know, I plan on that. If I ever get good enough where I can play in front of somebody without making a mistake, expect a recording.
Nice. Oh, yeah. Okay.
We're a very easy audience.
For the sequel. Are you taking this on the road at all in next year, or you want to play in front of people?
You know, honestly, on a more meaningful point, like with the ear thing I was talking about before, I'm really protective of them. And loud music is one of the worst things I can do for my ears. So probably just continue to make more recordings. And whoever appreciates them, I'm more than grateful. But the playing live thing, probably not so much.
Well, anytime you want to come out and talk about any of your upcoming records, we're happy to.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, we look forward to hearing more from you in the future, especially this banjo record. And thank you.
Thanks, Jude. Yeah,
cheers. Enjoy. Well, another great episode, Holly, don't you think?
I definitely think so. I think Jude is a super interesting guy. I think he's all the turns he's taken, he's very zen. I loved hearing about the Tony Robbins thing, and I really get that. I have a lot of respect for him. He's done what he's wanted as an artist and on the business side of the music. It's very cool.
Yeah, we didn't even touch on it, but if you want to, on YouTube, you could see him. He used to be the music editor for Extra, the TV show. So he's talked with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and B.B. King and a lot of his favorites. It's kind of fun to look on YouTube and see what he did when he was kind of doing what Holly and I are doing. We recommend checking out Kudamon and Coolerator. These are his two new albums, the first in 20 years. So kind of cool to hear Jude Cole make music again.
Yeah, he's got a great voice and really, really enjoy him.
All good things come to an end, so let's wrap this up. And until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.